item is the HBA rules briefing. Randy Thurston, Dave Price, welcome back.
Madam Chair, Commissioners, Dirk Anderson. This is the fourth of five planned overviews on the proposed changes to the hydraulic code rules. Oh, thank you. Tammy always makes sure you're able to hear me. So this morning, we're going to talk about three sections. The first section is actually a revised section, and that's the water crossing section. And then there's two additional sections, fish passage structures, and then beaver dam management. And these are new sections that are proposed. So fortunately, I'm very pleased to have Dave Price with me here this morning. Dave is the Restoration Division Manager. He supervises the environmental engineering and fish passage sections, and he is an expert on water crossings and fish passage improvement structures. So he's going to be doing the presentation on these two sections. And then I'm going to be talking about beaver dam management at the conclusion. So.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Director Anderson, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I tend to talk a little fast when I get cold, so.
So you're going to be going really fast.
So water crossings are very simply described as facilitating the movement of people or materials over water. And in the WAC revisions, we're talking about culverts, bridges, and fords. The requirement to pass fish in Washington is a very old story. It started primarily in the lower Columbia when commercial fishermen noticed that splash dams, dams used to move wood from logs from headwater streams down to valley bottoms, were blocking fish and influencing the population abundance for them. And as a result of that, nearly 125 years ago, the legislature saw that statutes were created to ensure that fish passage was required at these structures as well as others. That law was amended in 1950 to convey that intent to road and highway culverts as well. But prior to 1994, there was no guidance on to the regulated community on how to do that. So in 1994, a WAC was included specifying design criteria that would ensure fish passage. So when we're talking about fish passage at water crossing structures, what we're looking for are durable and efficient means of providing fish passage, but also because structures in streams can influence habitat downstream and upstream if those structures are incorrectly designed, installed, or sized. It's important that those considerations also include in-stream fish habitat. One of the primary changes you're going to see in the WAC revisions is that we are shifting from simply requiring fish passage to mimicking natural stream channel functions. And this is because the existing WAC is primarily based on the hydraulic conditions suitable for passing specific target fish. And that includes leaping and swimming abilities of fish. And because we know so little about the swimming and leaping abilities of fish, and it's difficult to convey that at every crossing, we're seeing the need to include natural stream functions inside the culvert, as you would find upstream and downstream of that culvert. And over the last 20 years, I think we've made good progress working with our constituency, the regulated community, in developing and designing natural stream channels inside of culverts. Just going to talk briefly about two simple designs that are included in the the proposed WACs. The first is the stream simulation culvert. And this feature culvert is a very adaptable kind of model. You can put this in steeper stream channels. You can put it in larger stream channels. It is a rather intense, complex engineering requirement to accommodate that, but it is a very adaptable model. Essentially, the culvert is put at the same gradient as the stream channel. We countersink the culvert 30 to 50% to ensure that stream substrate is always in the culvert. And then we size that culvert 1.2 times the channel width plus 2 feet. And then we allow for some alternatives that I'll talk about here in a few seconds. As I said, this does require some complex engineering. It is not for everyone to simply do. This type of culvert, no-slope culvert, exists in the current WACs. And it is a very useful culvert design for some stream applications. In contrast to the stream simulation design, this culvert type does not require complex engineering. It was in fact developed to minimize the engineering costs associated with installation, allowing those landowners who could not afford to do so this simple model under specific conditions. This culvert is laid flat, not at stream gradient. It's countersunk 20% at the downstream end, no more than 40% at the upstream end. And by doing that, with a stream gradient of no more than 3%, perhaps 5%, you can be assured that the stream substrate will continue to exist in the culvert through time. The stream the culvert width in this structure is generally about bankful width. The stream substrate inside the culvert is approximately bankful width. So major changes in the proposed WACC include stream simulation as the preferred design methodology. We think we've made tremendous strides in our ability to design these structures. We've provided a great deal of guidance and have reviewed quite a few stream simulation designs and feel very comfortable about this methodology is persisting through time. The other aspect of the changes was for bridge design, and that was largely to protect the habitat that we were seeing in terms of influences of bridges. Bridges that are too small, too narrow, can constrict the channel and actually undermine the substrate downstream, can backlog wood that might otherwise transport down the stream. So we've worked for 4 years to develop guidance with our constituency and feel pretty comfortable about where we are in our relationship with them. We think we have a good understanding. We think our constituency has a good understanding of why we're trying to do this. And then lastly, Ford designs. There are conditions where Fords are appropriate. For example, in ice-prone streams of eastern Washington, where ice can kick loose in a flood and completely take out a road. So in those kinds of instances and others, Fords are appropriate. And the new WACs include guidelines for those structures where they did not previously exist. Okay, so overall, the goal of the changes in the WACC were to use the stream simulation model and maintain a natural channel within the culvert as it would exist up and downstream of the culvert. The new WACCs provide design guidelines for culverts, bridges, and fords, importantly, I think, allows the designer some freedom to choose methods, not only in the designs that we have in the WACC, but also as appropriate, based on site-specific conditions, alternatives to those designs. So in other words, if there is a reason to deviate from what we see on the in the WACC because of site-specific conditions, our habitat biologists and our environmental engineers can work with those constituencies, those engineers, those designers, to find suitable alternatives. Okay, the second section of this is fishways. Fishways did not previously exist in the WACs, so this is a new section for us. unlike stream simulation, fishways are not designed to mimic natural stream functions. In contrast, they're designed specifically to pass specific or target fish, which usually includes adult salmon and trout, those species for which we have some ability to know their swimming and leaping capabilities. Fishways are necessary. We'd like natural stream channels to exist everywhere. Unfortunately, that's not always possible. We live in a place where infrastructure exists. We work with people. We work with infrastructure. So fishway applications are appropriate for temporary fish passage, passage at an existing barrier, especially when that fish passage barrier is going to be replaced in the near term. And roughened channel designs to get around dams or water diversion structures. We might construct an artificial channel to allow fish passage around those structures, recognizing that it may not pass all fish in all life history stages, but will accommodate those fish that wouldn't otherwise be able to do that. Fishways can be tricky, so we require an engineering stamp associated with those designs. There are specific criteria, and those criteria are based on the swimming performance of fish. And importantly, and lastly, fishways notoriously fail if they are not inspected and routinely maintained. So we expect people to go out and pull debris from these structures to ensure continued use of fish passage. And that's all I had.
Oh, Commissioner Smith has a question.
Yeah, quick question. Of all of the various types of implements, what percentage would be fishways versus culverts?
Well, that's a challenging question to answer because many fishways are associated with culverts.
Okay.
In other words, we have situations where we recognize DOT comes up a lot, and I'm certainly not meaning to pick on them, but where we recognize that a DOT highway culvert might be fixed in 10 years, that's a long time if you're a chum or a steelhead, and we might require a fishway to be associated with that. Honestly, it's probably less than 5% total if you had to have a number.
Oh. And do you work with the regional salmon enhancement groups?
Yes, we do. You bet. So our division of duties is mostly aligned with the department can help other groups find sources of funding. We can help them with preliminary designs and scoping documents. We can tell them if fish are present and help them along those lines. And then really the RFEGs, we look for to be the implementers of the project. They're the ones that carry the heavy water to see the project through.
It's a good partnership then.
We think so.
Thank you.
Commissioner Smitten.
Thank you, Chair. Dave, a question that seemingly may not have an easy answer. What's the definition of a fish-carrying stream?
Of a fish-carrying stream?
And that may be not exactly what it's called, but...
Fish, non-fish stream, sure.
Yeah.
We define fish streams in three ways. Known, where there is a known occurrence of fish, generally a written record that shows where fish have existed in the stream or do currently exist in the stream. Those observations are based on professional observations, not casual observations. So a tribal bio, a WDFW bio, perhaps a local government bio, an RFEG maybe, those kinds of observations. There is potential fish passage. Potential fish presence, where we know we have fish downstream of a barrier, an artificial barrier, such as a culvert or a dam, and for which we think upstream presence would occur if that barrier were not present. There's also the third, which is presumed, where we know we have fish downstream and the habitat is similar upstream, but we have not looked. We have not actually had a visual attempt to go find fish. So that's how we generally classify fish and non-fish. There are other tools, of course. We use electrofishing to document fish presence, again, using professionally qualified individuals to do so. I guess that's where I would start.
Very, very good answer. Thank you.
And now that you've given us that terrific answer, is there a simple way to inform us about the application of the rules in each one of those? Are they all the same?
So, yes, we generally use fish presence as a first starting place, and these definitions that I provided with you are mapped. We can tell you where they are. They're on our website. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have not been to all streams in Washington. There's just so many. Mm-hmm. So there are many, many unknowns. Whereas we have these good tools that are available to you, if it applies, there are those that sometimes do where we have no information. And on those streams, it's appropriate to have somebody out there to take a look at those. Did that answer your question?
In order to determine where that stream would fit in this presumed or...
Correct. Yeah. You know, sometimes you just get an inflection. You know, a fish passage barrier, natural barriers, generally defined as something 12 feet tall. So you have a stream and then a 12-foot tall barrier. But we all recognize that there are these little inflections on little streams that might be 4 or 5 feet tall that are pretty meaningful barriers if you're a fish. We look for those kinds of things. We look for gradient changes that could be sharp and sustained. And we have a pretty good arrangement with the tribes to know what that is. We have pretty good agreement. So if there is questions about fish passage or fish presence, generally we call a team of folks out there to take a look at it, which would include the tribes.
Okay. Commissioner Schmackin?
There is another type of water passage facility, too, that's not a stream pass. It doesn't relate to fish if there are no fish known in the stream system, and that's for stormwater. What's the relative value of that type of stream if, for example, you did not know initially that there were fish in that stream, but eventually you found that there were, in fact, fish in that stream? Do those stormwater passage facilities, are they complete barriers to the move of fish upstream?
That's a challenging question to answer as well. It might depend on the site. Often we see stormwater facilities associated with streams. Sometimes they're completely separate. Sometimes they are amenable to fish passage and maybe would be adequate in our eyes. And then in other instances, perhaps they are not. So it might depend on the individual circumstance associated with that. Typically, if it's a non-fish stream, that is a headwater stream that we don't think ever had fish, there are rules governing that. They're not fish passable type rules. They're just to ensure that something doesn't happen and wash downstream. If we happen to find fish in a constructed floodway that was not historically a stream, that's not something the department has regulated as a stream before. If there is a floodway that is constructed from a historic stream, that might be a different situation. We'd have to take a look at that on a site-specific basis, I think.
I have two more questions for you.
Sure.
The first one is, what's the relative cost differential between the two types?
Between a
floodwater and a fish passage?
That also depends. For stream sim culverts, I've seen them constructed for as little as $3,000 on forested landscapes. Very operationally efficient group. So that's extremely cheap. Typically, would of course going to depend on stream size. The amount of fill above the culvert will factor in greatly, as will asphalt. If you have to pave or go around it, that adds greatly to the cost. So $3,000 on the very low end for a stream simulation culvert, they can range up to $20,000, $30,000, $50,000. comparable size and situation in a non-fish stream is going to be substantially less. It varies so greatly depending on stream size. That's a challenge. And whether concrete is involved as well, because floodways often include concrete structures. So it's, I guess I could help answer that if I had some specific examples.
My last question is, what do you do in the case of an ephemeral stream that has pools upstream of the culvert or of the fish passage facility or proposed fish passage facility? What happens if you have something like cutthroat? They're isolated in those pools, but during certain times of the year, there is potential fish passage.
Generally, we consider those fish streams. Now, the remedy for how you might address fish passage might be flexible in those instances, but we would definitely classify that as a fish stream if fish exist above in isolated pools. I mean, in those instances, we consider them to be historically present and want to ensure that they would be present through time. So generally, we consider those fish passable structures and would try to work with the landowners to get fish passage there.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Come on up, Lisa.
Sorry.
Oh.
Thank you. I'm Lisa Veneroso. I lead the Habitat Program, and I just wanted to add additional points to one of the statements that David made regarding the rules on stream simulation. It's a very important point, and it may be coming your way when the rules eventually go to public hearing. And we're in the middle of a process that I just need to bring to your attention and to have on the record. What David described, and as was written in his slide when he was speaking about stream simulation, was the proposed WAC. And that is the proposed WAC as will live in our next draft, our fifth, hopefully final draft of this hydraulic code. What the public has seen to date, they have not seen that as a proposed rule for stream simulation. What they have seen in the fourth draft is the 1.2 times bank full width plus the additional 2 feet, which is the department's standard, which has been adopted in the federal court case, the culvert ruling, which is legally required to be applied to state-owned fish passage barrier correction culverts. It is not legally required to be applied to non-state-owned barriers such as counties, cities, forest landowners. Those three groups in particular have taken great issue with our fourth draft rules as it relates to stream simulation and the standard of 1.2 plus 2. So we've been working very hard with those groups, particularly, and their concern, of course, is cost. Many of these culverts, as Dave was just describing, can get quite expensive. And they saw the 1.2 plus 2 as too rigid and inflexible. There are, since the Department of Fish and Wildlife adopted stream simulation, we own that solution to passage. Other entities have adopted that model, but they have a different approach to get to the end point of simulating the stream through a culvert. For example, NOAA had a formula that was simply 1.3 times the bank full width, a different way with the intention of achieving stream simulation. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a manual that is much more site-specific oriented, that requires a more labor-intensive approach to getting site-specific information, but again, with the intended outcome of stream simulation. So what Dave showed you is we are maintaining the goal in our revised rules right now, and we will bring to you as a recommendation, of stream simulation as the intended outcome for culverts in correcting barriers, but we are not in the fifth draft going to provide one primary manner to get there, which would be our standard of 1.2 plus 2 feet. So I just wanted to clarify that. We haven't met with our other stakeholders, the conservation groups and the tribes, and we're in the process of setting up those meetings. So just wanted to provide that information. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, important topic. Thanks. All right, moving on to dam management.
So the last section I have to brief you on this morning is beaver dam management. This is a new section. Currently, we do issue HPAs for activities to remove or breach or notch beaver dams or to install water leveling control devices or beaver exclusion devices. But we haven't had any rules for them in WAC. So kind of along our goal of adding consistency and predictability, we're proposing to add this section. So water level control devices, this is actually an example of a Clemson Beaver Pond leveler. These are drain pipe systems that are installed in culvert openings, or they can be installed through beaver dams to regulate the upstream pond water level to prevent flooding. These, unless they're improperly installed, they can block fish. Fish do know how to pass over beaver dams. They have evolved in the landscape with beavers. So these devices, if they're not built and sized and installed correctly, can block passage. But we do have them on the landscape, and we do permit them in certain circumstances. Beaver exclusion devices are also known as beaver defeaters or beaver deceivers. So if you've heard that term, this is what they look like. These are fences that discourage damming, and they're trapezoidal shaped. These devices can also block fish passage, especially if they're not maintained and they plug with debris. So as you can imagine, the mesh here can collect to wood and other debris and can plug up. So they do require maintenance. But they are effective at preventing beavers from plugging up culverts, especially. So, you know, beavers played an important ecological role in creating and maintaining ponds and wetlands, and this is an important habitat for fish and wildlife. So beaver ponds provide habitat for juvenile coho salmon for rearing, and especially important for overwintering habitat for them. And these ponds and wetlands provide habitat for Olympic mud minnows, which are dependent on wetland habitat. Ponds also provide surface water storage, which improves summer flows, and they do a good job of retaining sediment, which also improves water quality downstream. So when we're permitting the breaching or notching or removal of beaver dams, we know that these have to be done in a manner so that the upstream pond is not dewatered and fish are not stranded. And that the releasing of sediment and large volumes of water behind the dam is done in a controlled way so that we don't get damage to downstream habitat. So again, although we know beaver dams are important for fish, we realize that they have a habit of putting their dams in a place that can cause damage to infrastructure such as culverts and public and private properties. So beaver dams that are less than 1 year old that are posing a imminent risk can be removed without any compensatory mitigation. This is an activity that's commonly done by counties and cities as part of their infrastructure maintenance, culvert maintenance. The removal of beaver dams that have formed a wetland habitat, established a wetland habitat, there is a harder look at those to determine I mean, obviously, if there's a threat to public safety or property, we're going to allow either the removal or modification, but there will likely be some compensatory mitigation required for that loss of habitat. It would depend on the site specifics. As I stated, there's provisions that cover the controlled release of water and sediment to prevent damage, and that water level control devices and exclusion devices have to be designed, constructed, and installed and maintained to provide fish passage. So that's another important part of the rules. Major concerns that we've gotten, there is an allowance in the rule for blasting of beaver dams under really limited circumstances. We had actually proposed that not be in there, but some of there's been some cases in eastern Washington where actually blasting was the least impacting alternative. So, but again, that's very site-specific and very limited. And, of course, with blasting, you don't get that controlled release. So you really have to look at the instance and where that's going to be allowed. Sometimes, that is in there. And that has generated some concerns. So I think it warrants some additional discussion internally in terms of those comments and how we should address them. The major concern, of course, is ensuring fish passage, and we have done that in the rules with putting language in there that the devices installed have to pass fish. So March meeting. So the March meeting would be the fifth of the scheduled briefings on the rules, the fifth and last. And I'm going to cover four saltwater sections, authorized work times, residential docks, outfalls and tide gates, and boring. The outfalls and tide gates and the boring section are both new in the rules. The work times and residential docks are being modified. So I'll be covering those sections, and that would conclude the last of kind of the overview. We've gotten, just to give you kind of a background of where we are in the process, we've gotten comments back on the draft programmatic environmental impact statement. I've consolidated those comments into one document. It's over 100 pages long. So we're in the process of reviewing those comments determine what we're going to do with them, if we're going to make changes to the rules. They all have to be addressed as part of the process. But so what we anticipate is it's going to take us a while to get through that process, and that we would probably be coming to you in July with the CR-102 because we're going to need some time to make some adjustments. You know, prior to that, we're going to need to brief you on what those changes are that result from what we briefed you on in the first five briefings. So that you know why we're making the recommended changes that we are, and also give you an idea of what the alternatives are, what the alternatives are that are being proposed by stakeholders.
Okay. So,
all done.
All done.
Now?
Yeah, all done.
Okay.
For now.
All right. We're making it's a massive undertaking. So. And really gets at the heart of some of the biggest conflicts and most intense disputes, debates in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Heard it. It's because it goes to the pocketbook.
It does. It does. Yeah. And we understand that. We have a job to do, which is protect fish life, but we want to do that in a reasonable, professional manner.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly looks like that's what you're doing.
Okay, well, thank you.
Commissioner Schmitten?
Thank you, Chair. And, really interesting. I actually read this part. I live in beaver country.
Yeah.
By the way, a beaver exclusion device, that's a great acronym. That's a bed. my question is probably more for wildlife, the wildlife program, and rather than removing the dams or excluding devices. Mm-hmm.
often our PUDs, our irrigation ag canals will remove the beavers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we have a trapper just up the road from me that does that for them. Removes them either live and relocates or lethal, depending upon the PUD's request or the irrigation mm-hmm. company's request. Is there a permit? It seems like the department should have oversight on authorizing that. But I know that all summer long he's trapping beaver and mm-hmm. moving them.
I don't know the answer to that, but I can.
So I'll ask the
wildlife program.
We'll be with yeah.
Not a habitat. I know we have, the handout, living with nuisance wildlife, and there's one for beavers, and there is some instructions in there about removal of beavers. But I don't know the actual if there's an actual permit.
The specific is why the difference if we can live trap and relocate? Why are we going to kill them? And he says it depends on the PUD. The west side, he has to kill all. The east side is a relocation.
And oh, so, really?
To me, that I want to know why that is.
Yeah, I'm surprised. Okay. Any other question? Commissioner Mankin.
I want to congratulate the three of you. This is a good presentation. It has not been boring.
Yeah, I saw that that bullet boring. But
yeah,
geotech
boring. Boring.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, you've made it interesting and easy to follow. Yeah. So we're with you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.